You are listening to a sermon by Jim Newdorf, recorded on Sunday, September 21st, 2014, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Victoria mentioned that I'd like to make this a little more interactive rather than having the response at the end, but more sort of response interspersed with things that I present to you. And so I'd like to start that way. We read the passage from Ecclesiastes, and I'm curious, what stirred in you as you heard those words? What struck you?
Didn't read enough of Ecclesiastes.
Okay.
Why stop there?
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. What was it that was drawing you further?
Pretty bleak.
Yeah.
I don't like to end on bleak. I don't like stories that end bleak.
Okay.
That's why I liked it.
Yeah.
I think it's realistic.
Okay.
And that's the way life is.
Yeah.
By golly, the sun came up. And when I'm gone, people yet to come won't have a clue who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that rings true.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, it is a bleak book.
That was the word of the Lord, by the way.
I felt I could resonate with it, too. I mean, it's kind of depressing, but I periodically wrestle with bouts of depression, and I've been in this week, I've been kind of in a phase of that. So I'm reading it and going, yeah, nothing new under the sun, it's the same old, same old. I feel like Sisyphus, you know, I try hard to get something done and then it
rolls back on
The rock rolls back again, yeah. And I'm just doing the same old, same old.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people of long ago will not be remembered. I've been thinking about how when we create something out of our gifts, you know, an artist or something, it is sometimes obsolete or not remembered or not appreciated after that person is gone. And it's not something that I necessarily bother by. I actually learned that lesson in the software industry. You write something and 2 years later it's all thrown away and it's like, oh well, I'll do another one. So yeah, it's that notion that what we do is not necessarily lasting beyond our lifetime.
Yeah, it is a bleak book. There's definitely pessimism expressed in those words. The vanity of vanities. You know, this is futility. There's a lack of joy in that book. You know, as I read that book, I didn't pick up that there was anything really positive in it. Everything is a burden. I heard that too. You know, in some of the responses, you know, it's just, you kind of keep plodding on, you know, because the sun comes up and you got to just keep going. I think there's also a fatalism in the book. There's this famous passage from there where, you know, there's a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill, a time to heal. A time to tear down, a time to build. A time to weep, a time to laugh. And it goes on and on. And we often hold this passage up as a kind of a virtue of acceptance. Yet when I'm reading through the book, actually, I don't get that. This is resignation. He's given up. What can the writer do about it? You just go with the flow. You have no choice. As I read through Ecclesiastes, I get very much the impression that the writer has a perspective of God as a watchmaker God. God has wound up things, let go of the key, and now it's just running. And God is very distant, very detached. And we're simply here passing time until death. I hear a degree of disengagement, sometimes sounding like despair. I'm surprised he even gets up in the morning from what he's written. There's just this push to keep on living. I get the sense that the writer is stuck. He has no way out. There's this hopelessness, this despair. And I think it's also, as Evan pointed out, and you, that this is actually part of our reality in life. There are definitely times when this describes what we are experiencing. Often it comes through as, we can't wait to get to heaven when things are going to be good. And certainly there's times, think back to when I was in business, there's the curse of Eden. We're always pulling up the weeds, all the stress and effort that went into that business, in a sense, amounted to nothing. That's the reality. So let's read Psalm 90 now, the first 12 verses. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God.
You turned men back to dust, saying, "Return to dust, O sons of man. For 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. You sweep men away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. Though in the morning it springs up new, by evening it is dry and withered."
How's that compare to Ecclesiastes? You're picking up similar sentiments. This kind of idea of futility, dust, we wither away.
But to me there's a bit of hope because we have a dwelling place here. Uh-huh. Whereas in Ecclesiastes, it feels a little, there's not the hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to me, at least, I'm picking up a bit of hope.
Yeah, I think you're correct. After verse 12, that comes through much stronger. Yeah. And I also hear echoes of the curse. We read the passage from Genesis, and we know that curse there. Adam is created for the purpose of caring for the garden. And I think we usually read about the creation of Eve with the understanding that Adam was lonely and he needed a suitable companion. That's the reason that text is so often used in marriages, in the ceremonies and readings. I'd like to suggest an additional reading there. Adam was not up to the job he'd been given. He could not take care of the garden alone. He needed a helpmate. Part of the curse that follows is the curse frustrates Adam's work with caring for the garden with weeds and futility. In the curse we read, "By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are and dust you will return." There's that idea of dust. "You turned men back to dust, saying, 'Return to dust, O sons of men.'" The echo of the curse. This psalm is attributed to Moses. Scholars are pretty skeptical about that. But it's easy to imagine Moses and Israel voicing this lament in their desert sojourn. Those first two verses there about God, you are a dwelling place for a nomadic people who have no dwelling place. This is one of their anchor points. Their God is their dwelling place. But I can also read this as a psalm that could have been written during the exile. The Jews have been uprooted in exile to Babylon. Everything that they knew has lost meaning. They're in a foreign land, a place that is hostile to them. And so I can see here the work of their hands amounts to nothing. And dust they'll return. There's a certain irony of me talking about a psalm. Grace is the woman who loves songs, and typically my reaction is to psalms is ambivalent at best. Inwardly, if she wants to read a psalm, I roll my eyes, because I usually don't connect. And one of the things that's has been really helpful for me is a book by Walter Brueggemann called The Message of the Psalms. He provides a framework to read the psalms, which I found really helpful. In general terms, he describes psalms as being of three types: orientation, disorientation, and a new orientation. Each of these is actually rooted in the reality of life. We talk about orientation. This is life that is life-giving. The experience of life makes sense. There's coherence and order. God feels reliable, and his law is at work, and there is justice. We sang this morning, "For the Beauty of the Earth." That's a song of orientation. We describe what's good, what's working. It feels good. Psalm 8 is another example of a song of orientation. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. From the lips of children and infants, you have ordained praise because of your enemies, to silence the foe and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you take care of him? You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings, crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds and the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, all that swim in the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. Everything is the way it should be. Echoes of those first days of creation there, when man and the man and the woman are looking after, ruling over the animals, the fish of the sea. So contrast Psalm 8 to what you've read in Psalm 90. What do you notice? Invite some comments here. Or for the beauty of the earth. How do those two make sense, or is there a, seems to be a disconnect?
I think they make great sense. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because we experience all of these phases.
Yeah. That's one of the connecting
points. And the older you get, the more you realize
that. Uh-huh, okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, being turned back to dust becomes a greater reality.
Yeah.
In the fullness of life, one doesn't really pay attention to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that it is. Both are part of life. Disorientation and orientation. Let's talk a little bit about disorientation. And it's in this place of disorientation, it's often characterized by a loss of purpose and meaning, which is replaced with a sense of futility. God is very distant, and there can be despair in this place. Justice and fairness seems absent. So many of the Psalms, you hear the writer of the Psalm complaining to God about his lack of exercising judgment, that the world is unfair. Literally, the world is out of alignment. We sang "Went Out of the Darkness," the book here. But you know, when from the darkness comes no light, when from weeping comes no laughter, when in the day we hope for night, nor any comfort coming after. That's a song of disorientation. Often these places of disorientation end up being really visceral. In the Psalms, we hear voices of anger that is directed at God. The speakers are often trying to motivate God to action, and they'll use various methods to do that. They will try to intimidate God, if that's possible, manipulate him embarrass him or shame him into action. Anything goes. And yet, you know, while that tone and language is difficult, it suggests a relationship with God that allows for uncensored, no-holds-barred conversation. And that's an incredible thing. This isn't a distant God. This is a God who's he's ready to take it on the chin and listen. I find this comment came up, but these psalms are uncomfortable because of their tone, their venom and pain, yet they are the realities and stuff of life. Brueggemann argues that we should use them more because of the faith it demonstrates. I'll quote, "The use of the Psalms of darkness may be judged by the world to be acts of unfaith and failure, but for the trusting community, their use is an act of bold faith, albeit a transformed faith. It is a bold faith on one hand because it insists the world must be experienced as it really is and not in some pretended way. On the other hand, it is bold because it insists that all such experiences of disorder are the proper subject for discourse with God." The disorientation that can be triggered by different things. There's a book called Transitions by William Bridges, and he makes a distinction between transitions and change. Change is what goes on externally to us. A transition is when that change actually triggers something internally. So two people can experience the same change, but their emotional soul reactions can be totally different. And that's the transition part. Bridges describes, and it parallels what Brueggemann describes, but he describes these transitions as going through three phases. You have to have an ending. Then there's this neutral zone of ambiguity, of things not making sense, of lostness. And then comes a new beginning. Both Bridges and Brueggemann make the point that this place of disorientation needs to be journeyed through. If we try to circumvent it, if we try to avoid it, we're going to do ourselves harm. With Grace's involvement with grief, I overhear various things, look over the shoulder, over her shoulder at the stuff she's reading. And, you know, people like Alan Wolfelt, one of the key people in grief work, argue that if you don't deal with your grief well, if you don't deal with your transitions, it will show up in another form. In that often is an unhealthy form, whether that's a physical illness, mental illness, it will surface some way. I think the other thing we do sometimes to avoid those kind of transitions is we'll numb out. Emotionally, we'll shut down our emotions so that we don't feel the pain. And Brené Brown, who's been on a number of TED Talks, makes the point that we can't numb our emotions selectively. If we numb our pain, we will also numb our joy. We can't be selective. And yet that's often a thing that we do. We'll numb our pain. I've done it. And sometimes we need to go to that place just because it's too intense. But then we're going to have to re-engage into that place of disorientation. And it's difficult. And it can take a long time. And you wonder if it's ever going to end. And as we journey through this senseless place of disorientation, suddenly we will be surprised by new life. Life will suddenly take on new meaning and sense with new beginnings which were unimagined, unpredicted. That's the place of the new orientation. Example of that, Psalm 30. "I will exalt you, O Lord, for you lifted me out of the depths and you did not let my enemies gloat over me. O Lord, my God, I called to you for help and you healed me. O Lord, you brought me up from the grave. You spared me from going down into the pit. Sing to the Lord, you saints of his. Praise his holy name, for his anger lasts only a moment, but his favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping may remain for a night, but rejoicing comes in the morning. And the psalm continues on that kind of similar sentiment. The poet doesn't pretend nothing bad happened. He references that, the pit, the grave. But what he's also doing is he's giving thanksgiving for a rescue, a restoration to a life, and that generates a place of thanksgiving. There is new life. And this is another part of our human experience. So just as we experience these places of orientation, disorientation, we also experience these places of new orientation. It's part of the human experience. So let's just going to look a little bit closer at Psalm 90. And I see there's three movements there. And each movement has a different tone and focus. So verses 1 and 2, there's this address to God, this dwelling place. It's a kind of a reference point. And there's that idea that Anne-Marie talked about. If there's sort of this hopefulness that comes out of that. But it's also a statement that gives permission for the venting of complaints. And then the next movement we see, verses 3 to 12, and this is the complaint. There's a strong voicing of this disorientation, this meaningless place, purposeless, it's futile. And then verses 13 to 17 is the petition. I'd like to read that again. Relent, O Lord. How long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble. May your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. May the favor of the Lord, your God, our God, rest upon us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Verse 13, there's a definitive change in the thinking of the tone. A way out of that disorientation, that futility, that vanity is seen, and it climaxes in verse 17 with establish the work of our hands. This is not a new orientation yet, but it's a call for a new reality to take hold. Out of the lament comes a prayer for God to show his unfailing love and relent. The final movement of the psalm does not see God as some distant God, dispassionate deist, as in Ecclesiastes. No, this God is compassionate and not detached. This is a God who desires to bless and give life rather than punish and only find fault. Establish the work of our hands. What's that phrase suggest to you?
For me, it's that we're being invited to join in partnership with God.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
To me, it suggests, it just reminds me of the verse in Corinthians about where we are treasures in jars of clay. Mm-hmm. So that reminds me that the work of our hands, I don't know, I just pictured a clay pot or something that's being formed. So it's establishing, it's creative, mm-hmm. it's not this way, it's not solid, it changes, and yeah. It's establishing.
Establishing, yeah. So it's not some cookie cutter mold thing, it's unique. Yeah. Other comments?
I got the feeling that it starts off where, you know, we feel humiliated in the sense that we're just a small thing, a part of this great big world.
Yeah.
And so the disorientation, the idea that, you know, we think about our existence in the whole universe, and it's mystifying and terrifying and all that. And then the last part, okay, let's get back to reality. Let's get to today, now.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And just let's make breakfast and let's get back on starting the engine again. Let's get back to living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brueggemann makes the point that that's exactly what this is, you know, talking about is it is literally work, you know, the stuff of our everyday. Yeah. It's not some mystical phrase there that the Jews are thinking of. Other comments? John?
Well, I think we do find meaning through our work, particularly if we engage in work that we feel is creative or imaginative.
Uh-huh.
Those of us who were in the university know that publication is terribly important. So you want your work to be accepted by peer reviewers,
mm-hmm.
and to get it acknowledged, to get it established, and get it in print.
Yeah.
And the same thing in art. People who paint and write and the people that do carpentry work, they're engaged in building homes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is engaging in creative tasks which lead to the eventual product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of my initial comment about there isn't enough, it was exactly this verse that in Ecclesiastes that talks about work being our joy, that this, just the ordinariness of our work, somehow if we can find joy in that, that is the gift of the Creator.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. One of the things I feel about the reorientation is that we have to hold in tension. I think that's how you survive, is you have to hold the tension. It's not all or the other. It's somehow being able to hold that there is a time for. To me, that's not a fatalistic thing.
Okay.
It's,
yep.
In my journal, I have a picture on August 26th. There's a picture of my dear friend who just died, her picture. And at the same time, there's a picture of this four-year-old grandson playing in the water, just like exuberance. And I wrote in very strong Gothic, there is a time for every season under heaven. And somehow it's not like resignation of either one. It's that this is the way it is. And I think accepting it is the way to, is the way of God giving us joy in the ordinary stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the text I was waiting for.
Uh-huh.
I think this Psalm 90 speaks to this as well.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this hopefulness here that I pick up for sure. Yeah.
I'll look at it a different way. There are many hemistiches in this, in half verses.
Yeah.
And the literary structure sort of says the same thing the second time, either opposite, balancing it, or repeats it in different words. But that pattern is strongly broken in 17. Prosper for us the work of our hands. Oh, prosper the work of our hands. It's a literal
yep.
repetition, which after all of the other craft, this literal repetition really hits you. To me, that's a plea that the work of the community will prove to be enduring,
mm-hmm. yeah.
long-lasting.
Mm-hmm.
You have been from everlasting, and for all generations, may we somehow contribute to that.
Yeah, there's this kind of bookending to it, right?
But I find that a heavy burden, therefore I like Ecclesiastes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a mess.
Yeah. What strikes me about this, and this is, I guess, in contrast to kind of my evangelical upbringing, where we separate spiritual and secular, and we make this really strong distinction. For in this psalm, that distinction doesn't exist. The work is just as spiritual as everything else. Everything is spiritual. And that's a striking piece for me. So what we do in our everyday is a spiritual act. And for the Jews, I don't think they had that kind of distinction. If you look at their laws, the Mosaic laws, they get into detail with the everyday stuff of life. How to wash your pots, right? And all those things, they are all actually spiritual acts. And so this is a prayer also to bring the spiritual into our everyday, ordinary, often mundane stuff and give it meaning. John, you use the terms creative and imaginative as giving meaning. What other things give us meaning in our everyday? Where do we find meaning, purpose?
I had an interchange with someone on Facebook yesterday or the day before that illustrates meaning from even from painful experiences. This person had shared about, she works in a place of art creation for people with mental handicaps.
Okay. Yeah.
And one fellow there has quite a talent, and he's better than most of the others. So she, well, because he generates so much work, she often has him gesso over something that's not as good as he could potentially do to reuse the canvas. Gesso is just like a white paint. But he didn't understand that this one particular one he was working on that she was quite proud of him for was better and worth saving. And so he, without asking her, just went over it. And she just, it was a tragic experience, and she shared that on Facebook. And then all the people that responded to her said, thank you for giving meaning to that experience you had. You said it so beautifully that it wasn't lost. Even though it was a painful thing, you've made it meaningful by expressing it. So I think that's one of the things that gives us meaning, is to express in words that God gave us something about how it hurt or you know, sadness or whatever, but that in itself gives it meaning somehow.
So by expressing that, that validates other people's experience? Is that what you're... would that be it, or is it a little different?
Well, no, she just explained that there is tragedy in destroying something beautiful.
Yeah.
And out of that came beautiful words that described this tragedy. So, I mean, it linked together with the event to make something larger in the grand scheme of things that had meaning for all of us who read it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Yeah.
You know, that.
Yeah. Okay. Where else do we find meaning?
Relationships.
Yeah.
It's a huge part, I think, of how one experiences meaning in life, even relationships that sour or unpleasant at times. It gives you a different perspective, a different view.
You had mentioned how when we look at change happens to all of us, but transitions, how we look at it. And I always find, you know, there's this phrase that God is in the details, you know, and that can mean different things to different people. So for me, the meaning part is when you slow down and start to look at the little things, they're just as important as the big things. And
the
idea of reflection and focus, because, I mean, you know, we all understand when we listen to the news every day, we have no control over that unless we get really motivated. But it's back to the relationships that we're referring to. It's the relationships we can control. It's the relationships we can grow with. And they're the one thing that seems to carry on after we're gone.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a birthday party for my niece yesterday, and a lot of the family members, they're all gone now. They've passed away, grandparents and parents and so forth, and yet you feel like they're all part of the same room because some of those pictures are on the walls, and it's a neat thing. It's back again about building a community and carrying that community with it. So, again,
What you're talking about there kind of suggests to me that another place of meaning is this idea of legacy. So the grandparents that aren't there have left something that is enduring, right?
Yeah, and it's not something that we can show, and it's not there in the concrete sense necessarily, but it's definitely part of the history.
Yeah, and I think I was thinking about this word legacy, and I think we sometimes try to make it too grand. And I think of my grandparents. I have some carvings from both of my grandfathers. I value those. They're beautiful. They mean something to me. Were they even aware that that might be part of their legacy? I'm not sure. Might have been. Maybe it was their hope, certainly. My grandmother, as part of when her estate was being cleared out, I got a book on archaeology of the Holy Land, and it was a book at the academic level. Now, this is a woman who is a Mennonite immigrant, and this spoke to me of learning and study, and not just sort of the warm, pietistic study, but actually digging in, wrestling with stuff. You know, so there's a legacy that she left. And did she know she did that? I'm not sure she did. But it has power because also that combines with her character, with how I experienced her. You know, so legacy. What kind of legacy were you leaving? It's tying back to that idea of relational. Legacy tends to be relational. Those are significant.
But if we bring about some changes in life, everything we do, if I as an architect, if I design a house, people move in there, enjoy it, and come back and say, well, thank you very much, and this is a very good thing.
Yeah.
Or if we are as teachers, in reunions, people come back and say, well, I remember that what you taught me there that made a change in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that meaningful?
I think it is, and that's touching on that legacy piece, too. And it's that idea of, I think, maybe another thing that we can consider as we think about meaning is God's formed you. And so by that, he's given you abilities. You've worked with those and developed those abilities into strengths and skills. He's also taken your experiences and used those to form you. And then you've honored the design by using those gifts. And it's that idea that I think we can find meaning by being who God has made us to be. And often we're uncomfortable with who God has made us to be because we see somebody else and we want to be like them. But no, that's them. God's being very intentional about who he has made you to be. And I think when we start living that place, we also find meaning. There's a second century church father named Irenaeus, and he writes that the glory of God is a man fully alive. And I think, at least what I read in that is, fully alive being living who God has made you to be in its fullness, intentionality, and just taking hold and engaging with life. We could keep on going here. What I'd like to do is close by reading the psalm again responsively. Because the psalm is a communal prayer. It's plural. It uses the words our, us. And this is a prayer of every one of God's people. Not just even God's people. This is, I think, a prayer of all people. We all look for a place of meaning. And maybe the difference that we have is that, you know, that third movement of the prayer, of the psalm, we look to God for giving us our meaning. We shift our focus. So often we want to invite God into our story, and actually God's saying, no, I want you to come into my story. That's where you'll find your meaning. Because in your story, we hear what we heard in Ecclesiastes, we're forgotten. If we ask God to just come into our story, but if we have, or ask, yeah, but if we then respond to God, he invites us into his story. And now we're part of an enduring story, something that's established. So if we kind of divide sort of down the middle here, and you know, this side reads the light print, this side reads the bold. Let's read this as our closing prayer.
Lord, have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, when you brought forth the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God.
You turn men back to dust, saying, return to dust, O sons of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. You sweep men away to the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. Though in the morning it springs up new, by evening it is dry and withered.
We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a home. The length of our days is 70 years, or 80, if we have the strength. Yet their span is but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass, and we fly away. Who knows the power of your anger? For your wrath is as great as the fear that is due you. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain our heart wisdom.
Relent, O Lord, how long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble.
May your peace be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. May the favor of the Lord our God rest upon us, establish the work of our hands for us.
Yes, establish the work of our hands.
Amen.